what are you doing here? You're making an apparatus that lights a light bulb without a wire? What's the apparatus and what you're hoping to get out of it, Wesley?
Okay, what I'm trying to do is find out the behavior of resistive components, lighting components, which would be the light bulbs, in presence of the high voltages. Back to you, sir.
You mean using the, looking at the light bulb almost like it's an antenna?
No, looking at the light bulb as a resistive component that is lighting up at the presence of a given frequency at a high voltage. Usually the voltage is about, right now it's about 15,000 volts, and the frequency that I'm dealing with is 100 to 120 kilohertz.
Right, I actually heard all about that. What are you, I guess this is a part of a bigger picture, but what are you hoping to find out or conclude?
Energy dissipation, energy gain, and all of the associated factors in presence of the high voltage and tension.
And when you mentioned this wire that got very hot at the last couple of inches, what was the significance of that?
In unshielded wire, which was representing only the conductor, that it was not connected from one side, but it was connected only to one side of the Avramenko fork, which Avramenko fork is built from two diodes. One is in reverse, connected at one point together. From the other point, you have these two ends of the two diodes connected in between themselves with the capacitor. Then, one end of the Avramenko fork was having a wire that was about 25 inches long. That wire, at the last 5 inches, was getting hotter and hotter. And at a certain point, I couldn't even hold it. The rubber on the high voltage wire was so hot that I had to switch off the device. My question to Dick would be, within 100 kilohertz roughly frequency, how could the standing wave accumulate exactly at this last point? Even if I cut a few inches of that wire, I couldn't get this wire to be not hot. Back to you.
Yeah, I think the question that John has asked, and I'm curious about, is the heat of the wire. When a gloved hand is over a piece of wire where 100 KC is flowing through it, and by the way, to answer one of your questions, Alan, everything is wired. There's nothing wireless here. So there's real wires going from a transformer through steps into light bulbs, for instance. When you feel heat through a piece of wire, RF energy on the wire could give you the sensation of heat. And the wire itself might not really be hot in a way that can be measured with a thermometer, but because the RF energy is on the wire, the hand will sense it as heat, and dissipation is taking place in the flesh of the hand.
Okay, so then when I disconnected the power, the wire was hot, and I could smell that is hot from it, and I could touch it, and it was still hot.
There is some possibility, Wes, that I think you said it was a leather glove. RF energy on a piece of wire can create heating of the rubber, can create heating of the leather glove, can create heating of the hand. And even when the power is turned off, the heat in the glove and the rubber insulation in your hand, you might still feel it. The wire itself might not be hot, so we got to be careful with that one.
Okay. So you say, but by which means the rubber, the last 5 inches of that wire, was hot, like you really heat it up with the torch. and part of that heat was also on the glove. So I took the glove, I disconnected the power, took the glove and cut touch with my finger. It was hot. It was not even warm. Back to you.
Okay, so the wire was hot with your bare finger.
I didn't touch the wire. I admit I didn't touch the wire by itself. I touched the insulation on the wire. The exposed part of the of that wire was only 1/8 or 2/8, yeah, 1/4 inch. That was the exposed part. I didn't touch that. I had the capacitors around. I was just afraid that I'm gonna get shocked, so I touched only the insulation. It was like a hot rubber on that wire.
Still had the power running?
No, he said he turned it off. I accept that the rubber was hot, Wes. The rubber on the wire is made to be a good insulating material for 60 hertz power. The rubber is not like Teflon. It's not a material with low loss tangent, low loss coefficient, what's the word I'm looking for now? Dissipation factor. At 100 kilohertz, it's possible that the rubber of the wire is a lossy material at 100 kilohertz, and the wire was getting hot because the rubber was getting hot. That's a possibility from what you've described so far. K2RIW.
So you say, what kind of losses to in within the structure of the rubber did I have? That create a rubber to get hot.
Yeah. Every dielectric material, if I took a piece of dielectric material and I put it between two plates of a metallic capacitor, so to speak, and now I change the frequency at which I put a constant voltage, AC voltage, across those plates, and therefore it's going across the rubber. Every material has a curve of loss versus frequency. Many kinds of rubber, as you go higher in frequency than 60 hertz, start becoming lossy. That rubber was chosen because it does high voltage insulation. It does a good job at 60 hertz. That rubber was not rated for 100 kilohertz. So it could be a lossy material at 100 kilohertz. And with difficulty, there's ways of finding out what the rubber is and what is its loss tangent. That's the word they use, dissipation factor or loss tangent versus frequency.
There is a lettering on the wire that says good for 15 kilovolts. And also, where do we have a plate? The wire was connected only to a Rominco fork and not connected anywhere. It was in my hands. I was holding that wire. And even though that I put that wire on the structure, it was still hot. I'm thinking about what are we doing with the effect of the electromagnetic nature or the electrostatic nature, because I don't see any plates of the capacitor or capacitive coupling that could happen to that wire.
Okay, at 100 kilohertz, Wes, you are a grounded object. Very little RF energy appears across your whole body. Where your leather glove and hand was around the wire, around the rubber of the wire, you've now got a 100 kilohertz or so signal on the copper of the wire. It in turn is going through the rubber dielectric, then through the leather glove, and then into your hand. And heat in that process is being created because your hand is a somewhat grounded object. The power, you turned off the power, you took off the glove, and you touched the wire. In the place where the wire was in your hand previously, the rubber was hot. Did you touch the wire in any other place, touch the rubber of the insulation of the wire in any place where the glove was not previously there when the power was turned on? Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
Yes, it is. The reason that I decided to take this wire to my hand was before I was trying to test the device with the light bulb. So I was trying to make sure that I don't have any shorts and everything is safe. and then all of a sudden I smell something. It's like the hot air that is blowing in my face. Not like you can feel the heat with your face, especially when you're close. So what I did is I disconnect the power, I touched the wire, and I felt, oh, it's getting hot. Then I connect the power again, I hold that wire in my hand, and because I had two gloves, then I was holding with one hand, and the second hand I was using to slice my the second hand through the entire length of the wire. Now what I have noticed is that below the 5 inches, the wire was almost cold, and then was completely cold. I could feel with the you see that one glove was rubber, and the other one was made from leather. So the one with the rubber, I could feel that it's cold. So that's my question is, are we talking about standing wave in here? Are we talking about electrostatic effect or electromagnetic effect? If we say that possibly we have the effect of my body reacting as a capacitor, but say we drop that one, what would be the next one?
Okay, the standing wave, I'm saying, is not so likely because at 100 kilohertz, the wavelength is a very large number of meters, 3,000 meters, and that would be the total wave, and a standing wave would have hot and cold spots that are roughly a quarter wavelength apart at the operating frequency. Even if you go up to a megacycle, the standing waves are still very big, and I don't think that explains it. I've got a guess. Here's my guess. That an RF energy is on the copper wire, that the RF energy across the majority of the length of the copper wire is relatively constant. In other words, there isn't a standing wave. Let me drop. Maybe the rubber of the insulation is not where the heat is coming from. I am reasonably sure that 100 kilohertz, a leather glove, is a fairly lossy material. The green rubber glove might not be a lossy material. If all of that hypothesis is approximately right, you would turn the machine off. No matter how you touched with your bare hand, the rubber insulation that previously was under the leather glove, you're going to find hot spots. The portions of the rubber insulation that were not under the rubber glove, under the leather glove, maybe you will not feel heat. So when you touch the wire with your bare hand, in places that previously were not under the rubber glove, was the wire cooler in those areas? If so, it would fit that hypothesis. That's N2XJN, K2RIW.
Yeah, this is an interesting concept. What I have to do is, if I don't have a thermocouple, I can take any kind of thermometer just put the thermometer, repeat that experiment, take the camera and put the thermometer while the wire is not hold in my hands, and put the thermometer along that wire and try to find out, or two thermometers, and find out what is the temperature in various points. What do you think about it?
It's going to give you more information, but it's not going to be super clear. Right now, my guess is that the leather glove is a fairly lossy material at 100 kilohertz or 150 kilohertz. The smell that you smelled of something hot, I think, was cooking leather. Leather cooking is going to give off a smell very fast. For the rubber of the insulation on the wire to give off enough temperature to give off a smell, you'd be melting that rubber. You'd be seeing it flow. It would be flowing away from the copper wire, if you know what I mean. So I am guessing that all of the heat and smell that you sensed was leather being heated by dielectric heating of 120 kilohertz, we'll say. And so if that's true, if that hypothesis is being partially confirmed, when you turn the machine off and you've got a bare hand touching the rubber insulation, the rubber insulation that was under the leather glove, I am guessing, was being heated by the rubber glove getting hot from dielectric heating effect. But if the rubber that was away from the leather glove is cold to the hand or reasonably cool, then it's not rubber that's experiencing heating, it's not standing wave, it's heat being transferred from leather glove, is my guess. Leather at these frequencies could be a fairly lossy material. Previously I was guessing the rubber of the insulation of the wire, I doubt it. And by the way, let me drop.
C2RFM.
The fact that the wire is rated for 600 volts or 1200 volts or whatever, that just tells you the thickness of the rubber insulation on the wire and its dielectric strength when used at 60 hertz. That's what the wire was originally designed for. But leather itself at 100 KC, where, let me pick a number, 1000 volts AC is on the copper wire, the hand of Wesley is relatively ground. The thickness of the leather glove, I'm going to pick a number, 16th of an inch, 8th of an inch. You're putting 1,000 volts of AC across an 8th of an inch. That's roughly 8,000 volts per inch of 100 kilohertz energy across the leather glove. With that kind of a strong E-field, where your body is relatively ground by comparison, can create an awful lot of heating of the leather. That's my guess right now from what I'm hearing. Go ahead, Alan, KC2RFN, K2RIW.
You know, this sounds a lot like electrocautery at this point, which I do every day. And I've noticed that when you go to cauterize, depending on the skin, sometimes you'll feel heat building up where the wire goes into the probe. And I've noticed that sometimes the wire will heat up in some patients, and in other patients you're getting the same cautery effect, but the wire is staying relatively cool. So I realized it really had to do with some difference in the property of the skin, possibly the amount of saline or natural moisture in the tissue. So leather is sort of skin, so you may just be cauterizing your glove. The wires are different. I tried using Zipcord once as a replacement for the cord that they sell for $60, and that was not the right stuff. It heated up really fast compared to the proper material. So you can just use like Donna said. Let me drop. Just run to Radio Shack, and for $30, you can get the infrared non-contact. You know, looks like a little gun, and that's great for measuring temperature. Really, really quite accurate, and has a nice small window, so you can check your wire, which I think you said was 25 inches or so long, and then do a test. You know, touch a few areas with the glove, not at the end, and see if that's where the cautery happens. And that may help you zone in on what's actually going on there.
Let me ask you a quick question. Stand by. Alan, in the old day, it used to be called a Bovie machine, B-O-V-I-E, I think it is, because that was a major brand name. And there were at least two styles that were used in OR. One was the a long piece of blue wire coming up to a handpiece that had a metal flattened blade at the end of it. And quite often a surgeon would make sure he's not tangling himself in that wire, and he would place that wire between his knees, so to speak, and that one single wire came up to the patient. Then there's a smaller kind which runs on zip cord, what looks like zip cord. It's two parallel wires coming up to a handpiece that's got two metallic blades that are like a very large set of tweezers. I am guessing that's the second kind. That's the one that you're referring to. That electrocautery machine or cauterizing machine, is it still called Bovie, or there's probably four other brand names by now? Over to you, Alan, K2RIW.
Yeah, Bovee's still probably the top brand, and I own a Bovee Aaron 1250. And the second configuration you refer to is just called bipolar, because you have the probe looks like a forceps, but the forceps isn't connected at the base. It's actually two separate electrodes. And at the tip, there may be about 4 millimeters apart, and of course you can vary it by just squeezing it if you have to. But I'm amazed that sometimes, I mean, most of the times you don't even have to squeeze them close together. Once you just come near the skin, and you don't have to touch it, by the way, I've noticed, you just have to come near it, you'll start getting the burning. In fact, the burning is so so bad, I actually use a HEPA-filtered vacuum and have one of my assistants suck the smoke in because it'll fill the room up with a stench that you don't want to smell. And that's what I think is going on here. He's cauterizing his glove. On the other hand, the other configuration you're talking about, let me drop. What they do is they ground, one side becomes the patient. They put a big adhesive ground, like a big ECG pad, onto the body, and that, you know, your body becomes one probe, and then you use the other uniprobe over the area. But I don't find that to be as good, and never use it. I tried it years ago, but I switched over to the bipolar, which was far better. And that is not zip cord. I imagine, like you had mentioned, the insulation is different because there is a difference in the heating of that cord compared to just standard zip cord. And you will feel the heat build up more on the line, on the zip cord. And in certain heads, you know, certain patients that I work on, and I usually work in from the neck up, you can feel a difference in how much it heats up. I don't know why it does it. It's just something I've noticed over 20 years of doing this. Never thought about it till tonight.
Okay, does your particular bipolar bogey machine have a couple of knobs on its front panel where you can set the spark magnitude and frequency and or voltage magnitude? In other words, the spark gap that occurs that's doing the cauterizing, it is a combination of AC signal plus spark signal, and particularly the unipolar type, and I'm guessing the bipolar also has controls like that. Is that true, Alan? Go ahead.
On my unit, I can only control the power output. The frequency is set. I have no control over that. And the spark part, this is the first I've ever heard of that. Although you certainly do see sparks.
Yeah, the unipolar one does have a couple of knobs on the front panel where you can set, I guess it's magnitude of voltage, and the other one is magnitude of spark. And it's a mixture of the two. And the unipolar one did run at one time at 27 megacycles. Do you believe that your bipolar one is also running at 27 megacycles, or have they lately changed that frequency? Go ahead.
Well, my unit does both unipolar and bipolar, and I'll be happy to look tomorrow.
Yes, and the way that cutting and cauterizing works is a combination of high voltage and a combination of high frequency by way of the spark gapping and or the 27 megs, which does create dielectric heating, which is very good at solving bleeders, as the physicians used to call it. In the case of the unipolar one, that metal plate that you put the patient on, at one time they were calling it a butt plate. By now they're probably giving it a more sophisticated name. And the fact that you're using a scavenging air system is very intelligent for two or three reasons. One, you're not filling up the room with smells that are not so pleasant. You're not breathing those smells. And second of all, if the patient was conscious, I suspect he would be alarmed by that smell. Over to you, Alan, K2RIW.
Yeah, it's interesting that they're made nervous enough by the fact that there's a vacuum. They think it's a a device for sucking blood, and then, you know, it's hard to tell them, you know, on the one hand, no, it's not there to suck blood, it's just there to suck smoke, and then, of course, the next question, well, what's burning? And then the answer is, well, you.
I think, Alan, you've got to be a little bit more diplomatic on that one. But the way you solve a bleeder, yes, is to create local heating with your bipolar, I'm calling it super tweezers, I guess you're calling it a forceps. It's a kind of forceps where the two blades on each side are insulated from each other, being fed by the high-quality twin lead. And there is, in the old days, 27 megacycles plus spark energy, and a combination of the two gives just the right amount of heating and cauterizing effect. And so by creating that very local heating of a bleeder, you're creating a coagulation which stops the bleeding, and I presume that's your major motivation. Is that true, Alan? K2RIW?
No, yeah, that's true. There's nothing like cautery. I don't even know if I would still be doing this kind of surgery without it. It's a true godsend. Every day when I work and I pull that thing out to use it, it's so important that I have another one as a backup in case that one fails. Nothing like it. It could turn what could be a very dangerous situation into a cakewalk.
Yeah, my guess is when you're working on certain portions of a human cranium, if you sometimes run across a particular, are we talking about vein or artery? Probably vein. The arteries are deeper down. So it's a particular vein. If you happen to run into one that doesn't show up, it could create major bleeding without cauterizing. Is that approximately true?
Well, we do hit arteries. Everything from the neck up is really well vascularized. And there's not much depth up there compared to, say, the chest or the belly. So you're going to run into a pumper. And, you know, in the old days, before I really looked into cautery, I would clamp it and then I would tie it off. The problem with that is sometimes you'll get leaking past the ligature, or sometimes the act of tying it off will saw through the vessel and you'll still get bleeding and you have to try and tie it off even lower. The vessels up above the neck aren't always as tough as the vessels in other areas of the body, so at least that's my observation. But with the cautery, what's happening is with all that directed energy and heat, you're taking a tube and turning it into a non-tube, and a tube that becomes a non-tube becomes a non-bleeder, and it's very effective for arteries too. I can have an artery that's pumping and hit it with the cauterizer, and like magic, it's sealed. And I'm thankful for the geniuses who came up with that. Cautery doesn't get nearly its due in this field, in the medical field.
I can see that. It's fast, efficient. I mean, to stop and tie off and to put in sutures and whatever and try to stop the bleeding, I can see how that's time-consuming, not always effective, and nowhere near as pleasant. And I can see how this cautery does the job very nicely in your business. Okay, so I think we've slowly concluded, Wes, there's a high probability that what you were smelling was hot leather. And hot leather has got a very characteristic smell. And the dielectric heating, 100 kilohertz with a very large voltage gradient. Voltage gradient meaning volts per centimeter or volts per inch. Assuming your leather glove at the place where it was coming close to the wire where you're holding onto it, that the portion of the glove was a 1/16 of an inch thick, an 1/8 of an inch thick, and you're putting thousands of volts across that very small number of inches, and leather is not a material that can be used at high frequencies without experiencing dielectric heating, microwave oven heating, you could call it. And so the wire getting hot where it was under the glove, and then you turn off the machine, and with a bare hand, you touch the rubber in that area. The rubber is hot from conduction of the leather, is my guess. and then where you touch the rubber insulation in places where previously there was no rubber glove, I am guessing the rubber insulation in those areas was relatively cool. And was it the rubber itself also getting some loss when the hand was nearby? By the way, the rubber would only get hot if the rubber was getting hot, either from conduction from the leather, let me drop, or because the rubber was sensing a high dielectric voltage across the rubber because the grounded, relatively grounded hand was an eighth of an inch away from that copper wire in that area. And a lot field occurred across rubber and across leather. In the places where your gloved hand, your leather gloved hand, was not touching the wire is now issuing that voltage out into air. The actual voltage drop across the copper, correction, across the rubber wire in the area of air was very little, and therefore it ran cool. So if that hypothesis might be correct, you would experience a bare hand touching the relatively cold where the rubber glove, where the leather glove was not contained, but the rubber being relatively hot where the leather glove was previously present. Is that approximately what you experienced, Wes? N2XJN, K2RAW?
Yeah, it is possible that it is that. I'm going to check it out. I was kind of convinced before we start to talk about it. Thank you, Alan, and all of you to help me out to understand that phenomenon, that the wire was lying on the device and get hot before. But I'm going to check it out again. Now, if we're talking about the sparks, which would be the target that is interesting to the guys that are participating in this conversation, in the last email that I have sent you today, and that was at 10:09 p.m., that was a consideration of ultra-fast spark gap switching approved for publication. That link was sent to Glenn. I'm sorry. Yeah, that was Glenn, Dick, and John, and also was sent to the publication to Barry. Now, the first link on the top, if you go into it, you're going to get to that article is from 1997, June 1, by John M. Leherber, Carl Baum. Carl Baum is a very famous name, and William D. Prather from Phillips Laboratory. Now, in the introduction, you have a very nice graph which says about the prime power, energy storage 2, and load, and kilowatt, megawatt, and gigawatt. It is... it says on it at figure 1, at page number 2, UWB production sub-nanosecond duration pulses are generated by successively reducing the time scale at which electrical energy is stored. What is essential for me is get the shortest possible rise time and the fall time of the impulse. And then when you go further with that, on page 5, you have a figure 2. And figure 2 is representing the electric field lines and pulse propagates through the spark gap with an inter-electrode gap distance prior to the breakdown. The field lines on the right-hand side are the transmitted wave after the spark gap switches. And also on another page, which is page number 6, we have a model of discharge panel of the spark gap. Now, what is interesting with it is that they were able in here to calculate sub-nanoseconds the timing, which is mostly impossible to be reached with the spark gaps. Back to Dick.
I know you mailed me some stuff today.
That is at 10:09. A consideration of ultra far spark gap switching approved for publication.
Which I do not have, and the error is on my fault. I had a major computer failure today. My son had to do some repair. The last thing that I've got from you is Friday at 7:56 p.m. I have nothing later than that. I once did have, and it's gone. You're going to probably have to resend that to me. I have nothing since Friday at 7:56 p.m. West because of a major fail of a computer. I had my machine was locking up today, and my son had to fix that, and it looks like I've lost some material in the process.
Okay, I'm sending it as we speak right now, so you're going to have a few seconds from now. This material K2RIW, and this is the one sent.
Stand by, I just found something at 10:09. Is that when it was measured? It was sent today at 10:09 p.m.?
Correct.
Okay, and it's entitled Consideration of Ultra Fast Spark, and it's the actual thing inside that you probably want me to click on is OPRIF.
The first link on the top.
And the link begins http://rfierro.econ. Is that the one?
Correct.
Okay, I'm opening that link right now. Fundamental physics consideration for ultra-fast spark gap switching. Is that the one?
Yeah, Philips Laboratory. And go to page number 2 and the first graph.
Page number 2 has figure number 1.
Correct.
Bring off with prime power. Go ahead.
Now, this one shows the sub-nanosecond duration pulses that are generated by the successively reducing the time scale in which electrical energy is stored. It is a theoretical and practical divergation over the spark gap properties. And it says on the top of introduction that the general limitation of achievable rise time for gaseous ultra wideband UWB high power electromagnetic sources is the spark gap. It is of interest for myriad application to produce, control, and accurately measure ultra-fast breakdown spark gaps. Now, if you just skip that and go to page number, that would be 5, figure number 2.
I'm on 5, figure number 2. I see a coaxial structure where the two center conductors are about to make a spark gap internally.
Right. And that would be interesting for you to make a comment on it. It starts from the electromagnetic propagation limit explodes.
Yeah, I get in the impression here that the major thrust of the article saying that it's very difficult to get a pulse rise time any faster than the one you can get from a spark breakdown, that it gives you an extremely fast rise time. Is that the major thing that they're saying?
Well, the spark gap cannot close in the less time than the transit time of the electromagnetic wave through the gap, and that is shown in the picture number 2. But when you go to page number 6, you see exactly the same coaxial structure, and it's a model of discharge channel of the spark gap. The spark gap is present by the circuit on that figure 3, which is valid once the discharge channel current is circuit limited from the simple equivalent circuit to the maximum rate of voltage of dt in the spark gap is calculated. So why did I really concentrate myself on it? Let me jump.
Yeah, that figure 3 shows a L sub S, a theoretical inductor for the spark gap. But that may be a little bit simplistic, because that arc, when you form it, is a very negative impedance substance. Go ahead.
Okay, we're getting closely to the point. Go to page number 9, figure number 4.
Okay, I now see a modified outer conductor of that coaxial structure. Go ahead.
Right. See, that would give you the speed. And then, if you go to just page number 10, which is one below, you see very similar structure that we had seen in week ago, the article about the laser beam being introduced to the space in between the two electrodes. Do you see that similarity in between this?
I do, and I've got a little bit of a problem with it. That is, figure 4, except for the little rod in between, is a very rounded structure, which is going to give you a very nice controlled voltage breakdown. Figure 5, where you've got those sharp points, in any reasonable gaseous material, you're going to break down at much, much lower voltages because of the spark of those sharp points. Those sharp points are giving you a very high concentrated E field. And what John and I have seen with our Wimhurst machine, and lots of people have seen, is that whenever you've got high voltage that you want to form first, before you get a breakdown, a sharp, pointy object like figure 5 at first seems to me like not the right way to go. They may have had another motivation here. Go ahead.
They do. The design maintains a quasi-constant impedance throughout the electrode section, which minimizes the intrinsic inductance of the spark channel. So the smooth transition resists the generation of the higher order models, and since the importance of the system is maintained through the switch region, the power loss associated with the switch is minimized.
I don't think inductance across the spark is a major detriment in your area. Your spark, the thing that you're using for a spark gap, is intended for a radar transmit-receive circuit. It's to protect the radar from the pulse energy coming out of the transmitter getting into the receiver.
Yeah, but we use the frequency from 3 to 9 gigahertz, which those spark gaps were employed to.
Those spark gaps were used on 3 to 9 gigahertz because they were being installed in the piece of waveguide that was operating at that frequency. The spark gap itself, as long as you make it the right physical diameter, you could put that into a piece of X-band waveguide or a piece of L-band waveguide. The spark gap itself doesn't care. That's the frequency it was being used at was only being generated by the size of the waveguide where you were mounting it. That's my guess, Wes. Go ahead.
So let me reword it. The frequency that was sent from the transmitter to the antenna was 3 to 9 gigahertz. Spark gap was never nearby the frequency of the oscillation. Didn't care. Whatever was the frequency of the oscillation, let's say 10 kilohertz, that was the frequency of signal sending and signal gathering, which signal by itself was 3 to 9 gigahertz. But the receiver was able only to receive the signal in between the intervals of the spark gap. Is that approximately what I see?
I think the answer is yes. I'll pick you up on the second, John. That spark gap is there to protect the receiver. The spark gap is mounted one quarter wavelength away from the main waveguide that goes up to the between the transmitter and the antenna. They chose quarter wavelength for a very good reason. Once the spark gap does arc, a short circuit a quarter wave away from the active guide reflects an open circuit. It's called the impedance inversion effect of a quarter wavelength of transmission line. The spark gap doesn't care what frequency it sees most of the time. It only cares what's the instantaneous voltage across the gap. If the instantaneous voltage across the gap, which is at the leading edge of the pulse coming out of the transmitter, is high enough in voltage, the spark gap conducts and then protects the receiver that's downrange. That's the intent of it. So it's only a voltage sensing device. within reason, the exact frequency that the voltage is on there, it doesn't care. It's just making sure that a whole lot of kilowatts of energy don't go into the receiver and wipe out that crystal diode. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
Dick, you already covered. I was just going to bring that point up. In fact, most radar units, the larger ones, use two of those devices to protect the receiver.
And John, were those two devices used half wavelength apart, or were they side by side?
They were side by side. Their gap was slightly different. The first one, of course, right at the 90 degree point at that quarter wave, would take the first blast. The second one would take anything that was any vestiges left over, and that did the protection, because otherwise that receiver would be turned inside out.
And did the spot gaps that you were using, John, on the radars that you worked on, was there also a so-called keep-alive circuit? In other words, in the middle of the spot gap was a tiny little whisker wire going over to a high-voltage power supply, and they called it the keep-alive. Go ahead.
The ones I worked with were the exact one that Wesley showed you last week. In fact, I found one in my toolbox, the 1B40. That's the only one I was familiar with. It only had two contact elements. There was no, bias, the keep-alive circuit in the ones that I had.
Yeah, the keep-alive circuit had a mixed blessing to it. Number one, the good news is because there was a very slight corona going on within the spark gap all the time, that when the radar pulse came along, the leading edge of the pulse, even before it had a chance to rise very much, would arc over and the receiver was protected. That's the good news. The bad news is the keep-alive circuit is a continuous arc in your receiver transmission line, therefore it's making noise. It is a noise generator, and depending on the sensitivity of the receiver, it could be affecting sensitivity, depending on the noise figure of the receiver. And I guess the modern-day radar receivers did have a low-noise preamplifier. In the old days, the very first thing of the radar was a mixer front end. But by the time you got to those radars, my guess is there already was a preamplifier lowering the noise figure of the radar receiver. Is that true, John? Over to you, John, K2LAW.
Yes, that's correct, Dick. And also, I was in... on some of them where they were using a transmit antenna and a receive antenna, which of course they got away from that because of the expense, but they were using two different antennas so they could shut the receiver up in a different method.
In the radars that you worked on where there was a preamplifier giving you a better sensitivity of the radar receiver, was that preamplifier solid state or was it a tube type? And was there an extra limiting solid state diode in front of that receiver? Over to you, John.
As I remember, Dick, they were all solid state, and there was a diode, like, it looked like the old barrel 1N64s that snapped into what looked like a fuse holder. That was a replaceable item, but the rest of that receiver preamp was a brick.
The diode that you're talking about that was switched, that was a put in like a brick, like you said, like a fuse element. Was that the mixing diode, or was that power protecting limiting diode? Which was that, Sean? Go ahead.
That was a power protect limit diode.
Okay, so I'm catching on now. You've got a small and large spark gap right at the beginning of the receiver input transmission line, a quarter wavelength away from the main transmission line waveguide going up to the antenna. And then the downrange where the solid-state preamplifier was located is a solid-state mixer, replaceable item. So the spark gap gave you the major power protection. The minor power that leaked past the spark gap was then going to be protected by the solid-state diode that's in front of the real receiver. And I'm guessing the real receiver preamplifier, even that was probably a replaceable module, because I believe that even that would fail occasionally. Is that true, John?
Yes, Dick, they failed regularly from electrostatic problems. They finally solved it by better shielding and better grounding inside the brick for some reason. That was solved. They were made by Motorola, this brick. It was a little gold-plated item, very nice. And they did go bad. And that the 1B40s that they used, would handle about 1,000 watts. So they were pretty well protected.
I have a question. So could I simply, because I have a good deal on this very weird looking light, the bulbs, spark ups, whatever it is. Dick said that I don't know how it works. I don't fully understand how it works, I say. Can I use them as spark ups, John?
They're more like, believe it or not, neon bulbs. Some of them used water. There's no H2O in there. Some of them use krypton, and there were a few other gases that they used in there. But some of them actually use water. Yes, you can use it as a spark gap, but they glow more than arc like you're used to seeing in your spark gap. There's more like a, almost like a neon glow to them.
Okay, it's a good point. I can try them because I have never think about even buying them. Believe they offer them for few bucks, $2-3 per piece, six of them. So just for curiosity. By the way, Dick, if you have time and you could look at this video with the spark up, it's about 12 minutes, but it shows variety of the spark ups and application and the real physical mounting of those spark ups and the role of the heat sink in it. And of course, damaging effect of me applying fuel, the high voltage to fuel of them, not really applying the proper heat sinks. Back to you.
Now, the spark gap video was what date of sending, Wes? Go ahead.
It was today, and if you go to the send email, you will find it, and it is spark gap tubes video SWF, approved for publishing, and it's 6:49 p.m. of today.
There's a chance I don't have that. I'll keep checking.
Keep checking. If not, I'm going to send it to you.
4 minutes, guys.
Done. Hey, I've sent it to you. Good.
Is it labeled consideration of ultra-fast spark gap switching approved?
No, it is being labeled, hold on, not consideration, no, it is being labeled spark gap tubes video, spark gap tubes video. I just resent that one a few seconds ago.
I've got it and it's playing right now.
You can even move forward. You have a nice pictures of a deer.
Yeah, it starts off with a Varian tube container.
Yeah, while you're playing that, I'm going to tell you something. It is also shown how do I open a radioactive one that was sealed in the container that looks like a can of beer. Exactly the same concept with the part that you tilt and you open up that. And then you have some kind of smelly powder that is there. My wife was helping me out to film that video. Plenty of information over there and nice pictures. Practically the variety of most, if not all, of the tubes possible is covered there. I have also another one that I'm going to send you the link, which is the one that is a little bit longer, but it contains probably another 10 spark ups that I didn't show on this one.
Dick, I think that powder he's talking about was a desiccant inside that can.
Yeah, that's what I was going to guess. And the reason why it's made radioactive is to help the arcing over. You know, it takes a natural radiation or a cosmic ray to initiate a spark if you're right at the threshold of air breakdown. A spark plug in an automobile has such a huge excess voltage, it doesn't need that. But these spark gaps, they sometimes made them mildly radioactive in order to limit the voltage at which they would break down, and therefore it makes the amount of pulse power spike getting to the receiver lower, therefore the receiver has greater survivability. So that powder most likely was a desiccant inside of that sealed can. You can tell, by the way, the pull tab on the top of the can, it was a vacuum sealed can, if you know what I mean.
That's how I saw it, yes.
And I could feel that when I was opening it up. So the condition should be... I wonder if the radioactivity after 37 years... No, it was 1977, older than my wife. My wife is 1979. I wonder if the radioactive material was dissipating during the sex.
The half-life of krypton.
If the radioactive material happened to be krypton, who knows what it was. I think the radioactive half-life is not a big deal for you, Wes, because the radioactivity, if I look at the leading edge of each pulse coming out of a radar transmitter and I try to calculate how much energy goes into the receiver, it's just a little bit of the leading edge depending on how fast it breaks down. And with and without radioactive material, it makes a very small difference. You're not using the spark gap in that manner. You don't need the radioactive material. You've got more than enough voltage to arc over that spark gap, very similar to a spark plug of an automobile. You don't have to put radioactive material in the spark plug of an automobile, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Wes, KQRIW.
Understand that. Okay, thank you very much for that. And we have 10 seconds. So thank you very much for your help, Dick, Glenn, John, and I appreciate today's session. And to XJ.
Okay, bye-bye, you all. Get your rally to be clear.
7-3 stick and everybody on the net. Have a great evening. Oh, morning, I should say.
And go up, sir. Can you?
Yeah, sure.
Good evening, Dick. Or good morning, Dick. Enjoyed the net. K4 NBC, Florida.
See you, John.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
John, I was on 147. You didn't hear me.
Time is 2:03 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater.
Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2.